Good morning. Well, you know, I think one of the things that song captures is how this love and sex thing kind of has two sides to it. There's certainly a side that can bring a lot of joy and a lot of pleasure, and there's also part of it that can bring a lot of pain and a lot of disappointment. And that's what we're kind of digging into during this series and being real about that. And Brian started that last week. And I don't know if you noticed, but how into it he was of having the bed up here. Did anybody else notice that? You know, was anyone else bothered by that? Or was that just me? I mean, I personally on the sex thing, I don't really need to see him rolling around on a crushed velvet bed to understand the power of sex. And then he goes into detail about the role that Wonder Woman has played in his early sexual development. I had to go home and purge my son's comic book collection. You know, it all felt so dirty after that. One of the things that Brian talked about that last week that was of some use to me was the idea that sex is a mystery. Sex is a mystery, that there's something more going on in sex than just, you know, kind of the physical thing. There's a lot more, which explains why we can't explain it. Right? I mean, it explains why so often our behavior and our role with sex defies logic. And he went through this one scripture, which I want to take us back to today, which is the Apostle Paul. He's writing to this church in Ephesus, and he's talking about kind of the mystery of sex here. And so it's in Ephesians 5. Take a look at what Paul says here. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. Now, that part in the Bible, that passage is actually in quotation marks. And it's in quotation marks because Paul is quoting a previous part of the Bible. He's actually quoting from the book of Genesis there, from the early creation account, and the time when God brings Adam and Eve together for the first time. And so Paul is just quoting there, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother, be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. A pretty specific, overt reference to sex between a man and a woman there, the two becoming one flesh. So we're tracking with him. Wow, okay, yeah, so that's, understand that. And then Paul says, this is a profound mystery. Okay, yeah, I mean, we understand that it's a mystery. We understand that there's stuff about sex that we just cannot explain. I'm tracking with you, Paul, okay? This is a profound mystery. And then Paul says, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. Well, of course you were, Paul. Yeah, that's, yeah. Why, of course, what else were you talking about? You know, of course there. I'm connect the dots, sure, you know. What is that? I mean, almost as if I was, you know, talking to a good friend of mine. I said, you know what? 16 years of marriage, and Nancy and I are just in a really good place physically. I mean, we're just making outstanding, mind-blowing, passionate love. It's just awesome. You know what I'm talking about, right? Right? I'm talking about Jesus. What? What kind of freak? What is that all about? You know? Connection's not obvious there. Well, what Paul is saying is, looking there, he's saying that there is a spiritual thing to sex. He's saying that one of the reasons God has given us sex is to be able to experience His love that He has for us. And though that sex is much more than just kind of this physical act, there is a spiritual thing going on there. And so that's why sex is such a mystery, because there's spiritual pieces that we just can't understand. There's why this profound mystery. So, now this week is where we take a look at the fact that love and sex are not the only mystery in our world. You see, love and sex are not the only mystery in our world. There's another mystery in our world, and it's called evil. It's called evil. See, there is such a thing that also confuses and astounds us, and it's the evil. We see certain things in our world, and we say, how do you explain that? How do you explain it? You can't explain it. It's a mystery of evil in the world, that there is an opposing force to love in the world. Now, evil has one goal in the world. Evil has a goal. Evil, its main goal. The number one goal for evil is to separate. It's to separate us, creations of love. It's to separate us from love. It's to separate us from our Creator. It's to separate us from each other. It wants to disconnect us. That's goal number one for evil, and there is no goal number two. That's it. That's what evil wants to do, wants to separate. Now, the thing with evil is God, who is love, has created everything. So evil doesn't create anything. It can't create. All evil can do is take something that God has created and twist it. All evil can do is take something that God has created and twist it. And so that's what evil does. Evil puts all its forces on disconnecting us from each other and from God by taking powerful gifts God's given us and twisting it. And what more powerful gift has God given us than sex? So evil puts a lot of force on taking sex and then twisting it. And that's the way he can cause division. That's the way that he can cause separation between not only us and our Creator, but us and each other. That's goal number one, and that's the only goal for evil. And so the result is we live in a world that's been twisted. We live in a world that we have all been twisted on this sex thing. We've been twisted. And when I say all of us, I mean you and the person in front of you and behind you and to your left and to your right and the person talking to you. We have all, in one form or the other, been twisted on this sex thing because we live in a twisted world. And so, you know, for me, you know, I don't stand up here today as somebody with an untwisted resume on this sex thing. You know, and I, you know, won't go into detail. I've told you the story before. But, you know, I stand up as somebody who, at one phase in my life, I had more sex partners than I can even remember or I can even care to count. You know, and it wasn't enough for me, though. It wasn't enough for me just to kind of be twisted in this myself. I had to set my goals and bring my best to helping other people get twisted as well. So what I did was, for this key, you know, phase of my college existence, I started a company. I started a company, and what we did was, we rented out lecture halls on campus, and we showed porn flicks every weekend. And I made a mint. I made a mint. I was not only satisfied to be twisted myself, I had to help facilitate other people's twisting as well. So all of us in this journey of sex, we all suffer from some sort of twist in this. And you need to know that one of evil's key tools is to whisper in your ear and tell you that you're the only one. Whisper in your ear and tell you that, oh boy, wow, if people knew my story, my basic choice in life is either to be fake and have community around me or to be real and have people reject me. So evil whispers in your ear and says, your story, oh, that's too dirty. You know, your story, you don't dare share that, because what are you going to get? You're going to get judgment. You're going to get condemnation if you got real about your story. And so one of the things we're doing during this series is we're going back to the Bible and we're looking at the words. What are the words of counsel that the inventor of the penis and the vagina and the heart, what does he have to say to us about this gift of sex? And we are also spending some time hearing stories from our friends and neighbors in this community about what their journey has been in this as well. And it's the combination of those two things together that I think we start to untwist this a little bit. So why don't we, right now, let's take a look at somebody else's story, one of our other friends and neighbors from here at Crossroads.
So you had sex at a very young age. At 14, what was going on in your life?
My life at that age was really pretty chaotic. There was no control, and I really wanted control in my life. And I recognized that I had this power, well, perceived power over guys with just how I was shaped physically and just sexually. I could, in my mind, get what I wanted from them using that. And so not only did it feel good physically, but I recognized that, you know, I could get attention that way. I could get what I thought was love that way. I could get just companionship that way. And so I, looking back, I don't know that I recognized what I was doing then, but I definitely used it. And we get to a point where if it wasn't getting me what I wanted, I would go further. I actually joke sometimes that I'm going to write a book called The Road to Hodom, because I just I just became a closet freak. There was just this constant wrestle of, I recognized this so-called power that I had to gain attention from guys and attention from people, and really a way for me to get the love that I really craved, or just even physical contact that I craved. And so I would go through this dance of really being interested in a guy and using my body and using, you know, just sex to get them. And, you know, I didn't always go in it thinking that, you know, we're going to have sex. It was, I'm going to do whatever I can to get you with me. And I would try really hard not to have sex, but if that's what it took, then I was going to have sex. And then it would come to the point where I'd feel guilty about it. And I remember there, at one point, I kind of learned about grace, and I felt, that's when I felt like, oh, I need to change. And then I would go through these seasons of, I would stop for like 3 or 4 months, not have sex with anybody, and which that was a long time for me in high school, not to have sex with anybody. But then I would get to a point where I felt lonely or something, and that was my tool to not feel lonely anymore. I was willing to go to great lengths to have love and affection, and I felt like that was the one way that I could be in control and I could have it. And I mean, it got to the point where I would be in the midst of having sex with somebody and I would look at the ceiling and be going, God, why am I doing this? Why can't I just say no? Why does it have to be like this for me to get what I want?
How is that working out for you as far as what you were hoping to get from these guys and then what the actual act of sex was giving you?
Well, I think in the beginning I would try to convince myself that it was working out really well, but it just became very apparent to me that, one, I got bored with the game. I started recognizing probably, you know, between 17 and 18 that it was very obviously a game to me that I wanted to show that I could get what I wanted, and then I wanted to make sure I got what I wanted back from them. And I think I just kind of was awakened to just the shallowness of it and the lack of real feeling in it. And so it got to a point where definitely it was more of a me trying to figure out, how do I even set boundaries? How do I even stop this? Because I had gotten to the point where it was just really normal for me to go to different places. And because I was numb and had had so much sex and done so many things that it was, I just didn't have a lot of respect for myself at that point. But I would find myself in positions where I would think, well, this guy must really like me. And I didn't really do anything to get him by using sex, so maybe he likes me. And then I would get to this place where it was very obvious that that was what he was after. And I would just be like, all right, I give up. All right, let's have sex. Let's go get it over with. I remember somebody in high school had told me something ridiculous. Well, I thought it was ridiculous that, you know, you give a piece of yourself every time you have sex. And I remember thinking, that's dumb, because I felt like, at that point, I had hardened myself so much that I didn't feel like I was giving a piece of myself. But now that I've grown and I recognize that I absolutely gave something of myself to every person that I had sex with. And, like, I've had to go back and, like, just pray and ask for forgiveness and repent and also just ask God to fill me back up because I gave so much away.
Can you tell us what sex has meant in a marriage for you?
I just remember just really feeling like it wasn't ours. Like, sex wasn't ours. It wasn't something that was just our thing, that there, you know, that we both brought in lots of people into to our sexual relationship. And then it took probably, I would say, a good 5 or 6 years into our marriage before I felt like it was, that God really wanted us to have sex. That it was, that he actually designed us to enjoy it, you know, as a married couple. Like, because there was, I still carried that guilt of, you know, what sex was and, you know, all the things that I'd done. And so I think now we're in a place where God has definitely redeemed it. And we have lots of sex and we have lots of fun. And it's, I can't even think in the past 2 or 3 years of times that I've felt guilty. I definitely feel like God has redeemed it. And it is something that can be, it's fun. Like, it's fun. And I feel like I'm starting to recognize, like, I remember I used to be grossed out by reading the Song of Solomon and just be like, God didn't really intend for all, you know, and reading it now, I'm like, he did, like, and he had the perfect place for it, and I just messed up that place before I got there, you know what I mean? Like, I just made it a little dirty, and we had to clean it out, and then just, and redeem it, and so now it's an amazing thing in our marriage. It can be just unbelievably beautiful. It can be healing. It can be just spontaneous fun. I mean, it could be lots of different things. And what I've recognized is now that I'm not using it as a tool to get what I want, the fact that it is just like this gift and this just absolute fun and excitement, and that it is just so much better than I could have imagined.
You know, when I... Yeah. When I hear those stories, one of the things I realize is how powerful of a gift these people are giving us, you know, by the courage of kind of sharing their stories in that way. And you may not even, it may be years from now until you realize what kind of gift they gave you by kind of sharing their journey. When Jen was talking there, you know, she's talking about the amazing, you know, power that this thing is, though. You wonder, well, you know, it has this amazing power and it's this amazing thing. Why couldn't she experience it without kind of that baggage and that stuff that was happening there? Why is that the story for so many of us? Why can't it be just this thing that we have and this awesome thing, and then it's not connected with kind of these other kind of emotional baggage and spiritual stuff and, you know, all that? I think we start to see a clear picture of that from the way that God talks about this kind of stuff in the Bible. For instance, I'll show you here. There's this place in the where God's talking about our physical bodies in the Old Testament of the Bible in the book of Leviticus. And he's describing the fact of our flesh and our blood and the physical blood that flows through our body that helps us keep living. And here in Leviticus it says, "For the life of a creature is in the blood." The life of a creature, and he's describing the actual blood that flows through our body is part of the way that we have life. And the word, interesting here, the Hebrew word that's used there in the Bible for blood is nephesh. So the life of a creature is in the nephesh. Okay? Hold that thought for a second. Now we'll go to another place in the Bible where God is talking. This is in the book of Psalms. And this is a very well-known psalm. It may be kind of the most famous one, called the 23rd Psalm. And take a look at what God says here. It says, "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul." Say, well, that's nice, and that's a nice, you know, kind of peaceful passage, but what does that possibly have to do with that other passage? Well, when the Bible's speaking here, and it talks of soul, it says, "He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my nephesh." The exact same Hebrew word, out of all the Hebrew words that God had to use in the Bible for that word, he chooses the exact same word to describe the physical blood that's flowing through our body and our soul. It's our nephesh. See, we get this picture over and over in the Bible, is that God doesn't look at us in segments. He looks at us holistically. And he gave us a body, and it's not just this temporary, necessary evil. It is a spiritual thing he's given us, and it is woven together with our soul. Now, here's where the twist comes for us. We live in a world that is primarily, exclusively, separated body and soul. Sometimes people by accident, sometimes very strategically and with a lot of forethought, our society has worked very hard to try to separate body and soul. And it's interesting because it kind of falls in two camps. There's two loud voices we hear on this. One voice would be the camp that says, you know what, our souls are this precious spiritual thing, and then our bodies, they're kind of this necessary evil. They're necessary even though they're kind of dirty. We don't want to talk about that. Anything that has to do with the body is not spiritual. It's kind of dirty. And the less we talk about it, the better, really. So, you know, and when it comes, you know, like sex, put that in the camp. Sex, that's one of those things, necessary part of the body we have to have, but it's kind of dirty. The less you talk about it, the better. And, you know, I call this camp the prudes. The prudes. Because what they want to say is there's this beautiful spiritual thing of a soul, but the body, oh, it's this dirty thing, we shouldn't talk about it. And for instance, this camp would take, hypothetically, take great offense at the fact that we put the word sex on our corner sign here, and might even go so far as to call us up at the office during the week, you know, and complain about it. Hypothetically. It might do that. And you know what the prudes do? They say, they're basically, what they're doing is they're separating body and soul. They're saying there's a spiritual piece and there's this physical piece, which is totally separate. Now, the prude camp has been a very popular one for religious types over the years. They love to camp out in this area. They love to camp out in this area and focus on the spiritual and say the body, you know, that's not part of it. And sometimes have even institutionalized it. Like, for instance, there's this one first century theologian named Jerome, who had an incredible impact on the church. He helped helped result in a lot of the early Latin translations of the Bible, things like that, some wonderful things. But he was suffering from his own twist on these things. So Jerome was very much a separation guy of soul and body being this dirty little thing we just better off not even talk about. So, for instance, Jerome is quoted in one of his writings as saying that any husband who is too passionate of a lover with his wife is committing adultery. Whoa, I don't know, I'm no psychologist, but I think there may have been one first century theologian who had a little repressed stuff going on there, you know. I'm not sure. Prudes love to say it's a spiritual, soul is a spiritual thing and the body that's necessary, we don't even talk about that. So they separate body and soul. Now here's the thing, they're not the only camp that does this. There's another camp. There's the prudes over here. There's another camp. And what these people say is they say that your body is just your body. It's just a physical thing. So whatever you want to do with it is fine. There's no intricate connection between your body and your spirituality or your emotions or anything. It's just a separate thing. Your body, we're another animal, and it's this natural impulse, and we would all do better if we would just stop fighting our impulses. And so they separate body and soul. They separate body and soul by what they do is they say that it's this natural craving that you have and you need to indulge it. So when you feel thirsty, you drink. When you feel hungry, you eat. When you feel sexy, you sex. That's just what you do. And the problem there is they have too low of a view of sex. They have too low a view of sex, of that all sex is this physical thing, just like eating and drinking, and it'll never be anything more. So they have such a low view of this. I call them the pessimists. The pessimists. That sex is just this physical act. That sex is just this physical act, the same as when I eat or anything else. Now, here's the deal. We all tend to slide one of these two camps. And I know a lot of us, we camp out in kind of that pessimist camp. And that kind of is defining a lot of our culture, at least in my lifetime. And the problem is, in the pessimist camp, when you start to buy into that, what you are saying is, I can surrender myself unconditionally physically to this person. And I want you to surrender yourself unconditionally physically to me, completely open and naked with each other. And I want to love you in that way. And I need to keep my options open. And I need to keep my options open because I am just a physical thing. And so I'm surrendering you physically and you're surrendering to me physically. But these other parts, I need to keep my options. And what we're doing, whether you realize it or not, is we are signing up for what may be the most time and true history-proven recipe for pain you will ever find in this world. Unconditional intimacy with conditional commitment. Unconditional intimacy with conditional commitment leads to pain. Why? Because God is trying to punish us? No, because that's not how we were designed. And so just like if I tried to walk down the street and tear off my leg and have it walk down a different street at the same time, God's not trying to punish me, but I'm not designed to do that. We are not designed to rip body from soul. We are designed, if we unconditionally commit intimately to someone, we are unconditionally committing to them in every way as well. We are completely surrendering to them. Which is why, you know, like I know early in my life, a lot of us guys, we basically thought that marriage was, that romance was this great emotional trick God had played on guys. You know, because what it basically did was romance, it got you in love long enough to get married. Commit. And then you were stuck, you know, is, you know, kind of the thing. And you know what I found? What I found now in 16 years of marriage and multiple times through the marriage counselor and working through our relationship and all that, I have found that the deeper truth is that marriage, if you commit to it, keeps you together long enough to find love. Eventually. Because you can't split body and soul. And when we fall into the camp, what we tend to do, our lives tend to look like they're defined by trying to get close to people without getting hurt. Because we all know the damage that's involved. For our lives become all about managing this in some way. We get close without getting hurt. And that was a camp that I fell into a long time because I honestly thought I had discovered a secret. I had discovered a shortcut to manhood. You know, so here we are. I could have sex with a lot of women, and so I could feel like a man without actually having to be one. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. We cannot split body and soul. The dirty little secret is both camps have way more in common with each other than they think. And they would take great offense if I told them that they had a lot in common with each other because they spend time throwing rocks at each other. They hate each other often. But the fact is, both are doing the same thing. Both are trying to split body and soul, and both camps kill. And it may be small little cuts over time, or maybe large gashes immediately, but both camps end up in death. We can't split body and soul without paying a price. Let's look at somebody else's story.
What role has sex played in your life?
You know, in my life, sex has been as prevalent as anything else I can remember. I remember when, you know, the first time I saw pornography, right? And I remember how that looked to me and how that opened up this giant fantasy thing. You know, I joined the Marine Corps and so I was gone and I was away and then it then it all became very emasculating, right? Sex became everything. All the guys talked about sex. Sex was all that's all we ever talked about. It was what conquest we had, what girl we were with. Women, to me at that time, became very just a facility, right? They were simply there for me to choke and try to have sex with. I mean, that was all I ever, and I didn't value women in my life. I didn't see women in my life as anything other than, how can you meet this need for me? I remember very clearly in my life, you know, my first STD, right? I remember here I am in Thailand, and I go and do the thing with the person, right? And 2 days later, I'm going to the clinic, right? And I remember very clearly the doctor looking at me saying, I got a shot for one of them, and the other one you will have the rest of your life. And it didn't faze me. Then I became somewhat more empty, right? So I tried more and more to fill and fill and fill and fill this void that I had inside of me. And for me, this was how I did it. I did it through sex. I would go and have sex with someone and then actually feel worse, right? So then I would want to have sex with someone else to try to make myself feel better. There was always this fantasy that, you know, sex was like it was in porn, right? There's, you know, it's always so, you know, bam, chicka, bam, bam, you know, it's got all this stuff going on in it. I always felt like I was looking for that, right? That fantasy experience. And so never finding that, always feeling worse about the endeavor before, trying to make up for that to try to somehow make myself feel better.
So what changed?
My daughter's born, right? And I'm holding her, and she's all of 4 minutes old, and I feel the emptiest I've ever felt in my entire life. All I knew was that I had brought another person into this world for my own selfish reason. I was overwhelmed with guilt that this was the product of some empty endeavor to try to fill a hole in my life that I was never going to fill. Then one day I was sitting in service, and that there it was. That was the moment. It resonated. It clicked. I understood it. 2 months later, I was baptized, right? And I remember very intently getting in the water, getting out of the water, and feeling like the weight of the world had been lifted off my shoulders. Sex, for me, at this point in my life, is something I look forward to with my wife, right? When I find her, when God puts her in my life, I cannot wait for the time that I get to enjoy that with my wife.
Do you still feel free from the burden of the temptation of sex, or is that something you still struggle with right now?
It has been almost 2 years since I've had sex. I struggle with it every day, right? There are times in my life today where, I mean, I'm a guy, right? I'm 34 years old, and I don't have cable in my home, right? Because I don't want the temptation of having to watch Cinemax at 1 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday, right? But even then, I can't escape it, right? It's on every single regular television show, and it's like they push the envelope more and more all the time. So everywhere in my life, it is pushing in on me.
So what saves you?
It is the hope that one day I will enjoy the life with whoever God has put in my life. Those nights when, you know, you're just like, man, if I could just, right, go out and do this. Then I remember, right, that there's someone out there for me. It is hope. It is hope that saved me.
And if she's not out there, will it be worth it?
Absolutely. When I stopped having sex with women, I got to meet these totally cool people. Right? I mean, like, you got to be kidding me. Like, on the other side of the conversation, there are these totally awesome people with these totally awesome stories. I could have never had any of this had it not been for Jesus Christ. Right? I could have very well perpetuated, you know, the rest of my life having sex. And having sex, and having sex, and having sex, and having sex, and having sex. To no end. To absolutely no end.
You know, I hear Stephen's story, and here you've got this guy, this United States Marine, who is tough enough to have dealt with stuff that I've never even had need to see, you know, but yet it's this thing that becomes this kind of jagged cut in his life, and you wonder, why is that? What is it about this mysterious thing? And I think when you hear Jen's story, you know, it makes me think of, you know, kind of the pessimists and the prudes, and how they have too low of a view of sex. Their expectations aren't high enough of what it can deliver to them. When I hear Stephen's story, I see there's this whole other pit that we can fall into, which is we can have too high of a view of sex. We can have too high of expectations of what sex is going to do for us, of what sex is going to bring us. And we can take kind of one sliver of this gift God has given us and focus all our hopes for connectedness, all our hopes for fulfillment on that one thing, even though it wasn't designed to carry that kind of weight. I have mentioned in here before about I spent the early years of my life in Nigeria. There's a little group photo. This is my boys' club, I think, is what. No, it was. If you have a little trouble picking my brother and I out of this of this photo, you want to go down in the lower right. We have white shirts on. You know, so we lived in this area called Oshogbo. And in that area, Oshogbo, some of the local tribes, what they had done is they had grown to focus their lives on fertility. So their entire reason for being, their entire desire for commitment and contentment and fulfillment in their life was all related to how well they could procreate. You know, how reproductive they could be, how many children could they have, and how good were they at that. So much so that they had developed the local kind of form of voodoo there was called juju. And the local juju priest developed this one woman who was the priestess. She was the juju priestess named Susanna of fertility. And she went in the jungle and she built this huge shrine and these huge statues. And the women from the villages would come in and she would perform these rituals and these cleansing things with them because she was the goddess of fertility and so could help them become more fertile. And they totally focused on fertility and they worshipped it. Now we see that as, you know, like 2007 Americans, we see that, isn't that silly, a goddess of fertility and they're all worshiping fertility. How kind of archaic, you know, is that? You know what? We do the same thing. And here's what I mean. Our English word for love, there's basically one word, love. You know, and we use that for everything to connote all kinds of different love. But the Bible, some of the earliest manuscripts of the New Testament of the Bible came from ancient Greek. They were written in ancient Greek. And there, they weren't constrained to one word for love. So in different times talking about different kinds of love, they would use a different word. So for instance, agape is one that comes up in the Bible. And the word agape, that describes God's unconditional love for us. God so loved the world, he agape, this unconditional love from God. But it's not the only a Greek word for love that's used in the Bible. You know, there's other ancient Greek words for love. For instance, phileo. Phileo. And what that is describing is brotherly love, the love that we have for a friend, that a friend has. So for instance, that's where we get Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love, comes from phileo. That is the friendship, the love that one friend has for another. And then there's storge. Storge is familial love. It's family love. It's a love that a parent has for a child has for their parent, siblings have for each other. It's family love. And then another Greek word that's also used for love, and all these words we translate just with the word love. Another word is eros. And eros, of course, we get the word erotic from. That is romantic love. That's passionate romantic love, and that includes sex. All those words are used. Now, here's the twist for us. The twist is that most of us in our world, we are disconnected from agape. We're not feeling it in our life. We don't go through on a daily basis and feel the reality that there's a God who knows every dirty little thing about us and loves us. So we don't feel connected from agape or what that means in our life on a regular basis. And then when it comes to storge, family love, some of us grew up in families where there just wasn't much about love. And so we haven't experienced storge love, or even if we did grow up in a healthy family that was about love, the chance that we're still living in the same city as them, or the chance that we're still living close enough to them that we experience life on a daily basis with our family is pretty slim. So most of us are almost completely disconnected from storge love in any kind of regular basis. And then phileo, there's a friendship love. You know, some studies have shown that confidentially when men respond to surveys, they admit that they do not have what they would describe one real friend in their life. The average American guy has less than one, zero real friends, people who they can really be honest about with their lives about. And, you know, women, it's, you know, not a lot better. And what all of us tend to fall in, instead of using friendships in our life to share our lives with others, we tend to use friendships to compare and contrast our lives with those around us, kind of as a scorecard. And so we don't really have phileo. We don't really have a friend love going on in our life. So what's left? What's left of love? Eros. That's it. So what do? We put it all on eros. All of those needs that we're trying to get met, we completely put on eros. So all of my need for connection, all of my need for commitment, all of my need for fulfillment in life, it's all on eros. Eros has to deliver all those things. We're doing the same thing that my old Nigerian neighbors used to do. They would slice off one little sliver of God's gift of love. In their case, it was reproduction and being able to have children and fertility, and worship that. We slice off one little sliver of God's love, eros, and we worship that. And we look to that for all of our needs, which is why in Stephen's story, he would talk about, oh, I had sex with this person, and it didn't quite do it, so then I had to have sex with somebody else, and then somebody else. And it's the trap that I fell into as well, because what you're doing is, you're saying, well, this isn't quite giving me what I thought it would, so the answer must be more of that same thing. As opposed to the answer maybe being, maybe there's something different here that's supposed to fill in around this. And you know what we do, actually? I would say we put it all on eros, and that's been going on for like the last 100 years in our country. You know what's been going on for the last 30 or 40 years? We have sliced it even thinner. We put it all on orgasm. We put it all on orgasm, and we worship orgasm, and it all becomes about that. And I think if I could kind of do some time travel and take some of my neighbors from 35 years ago in a shogbo over here, bring them here, turn on the TV for 15 minutes, they would say, what is going on? These people worship orgasm. We put it all on that, and we expect that to meet all our needs. We do the same thing. And what happens with that is we start to find that increasing and increasing amounts of the same thing aren't doing it. So that's what we're going to continue to unravel in this series. Is what is this mind-blowing, awesome gift of sex all about? Why do some of us not expect enough of it and others expect too much of it? And what's kind of the role of health in this? Now, I want to tell you, as you stick with us during this series, I want to tell you it's not going to go easy. It's not going to go easy. It's because what's going to happen is evil does not give this one up easy. This is a huge thing that evil likes to twist for us because of the damage that it does to us, both with God and with each other. So what will happen is these lies may start to kind of fall away a little bit of some of these things you believe, but you know what? They're going to be replaced by even more powerful ones. And one of the little whispers in your ear you'll start to hear over the next couple of weeks is you start to hear, yeah, but that all may be true, but I'm alone on this. I got to figure this out by myself. And surely I can't admit to how twisted my journey has been, because all I'm going to get is I'm going to get shame back, or I'm going to get judgment from people. And if that's a whisper that you start to hear, I really want to encourage you more than I can encourage you to do anything else this fall. It would be check out one of our community groups. You know, check out one of our community groups. They don't all have to deal with sex. Some of them do have to deal with kind of twist, how we've been twisted in sex, but not all of them. Others are just simply about, you know, your spiritual journey. Others are just about reading a book and kind of connecting with some friends over it. But all of them help develop all these facets of love in our life. The other, though, I think most powerful lie that you'll start to hear, and it's the one that I heard whispered in my ear when I really started wrestling with this stuff, is you'll start to hear, wow, that makes a lot of sense. That certainly explains a lot of, it certainly explains a lot of my world around me and why things have happened the way they have in my life and why what I thought was going to make me happy hasn't. And I heard all that, and then I heard this whisper say, yeah, that's all true. Too bad it's too late for you. Boy, wow, that would have been great to have known 10 years ago. But for you, though, Brian, too late for Brian. You know, with your story, with your sex resume on this, yeah, you can do better, but you are never going to be totally healed on this. You really think that some woman's going to want to marry you once they know what your past has been? Do you really think you can get to a place where you can enjoy all the mind-blowing description of sex that God gives you? No, you have forfeited that. Yeah, you can do better. Yeah, you can, but you can't be totally, totally whole on this thing. And what you'll start to do is you'll start to fall prey to that lie. That's what I call the myth of the stain. And the stain often gets perpetuated by many religious circles. Because what the stain says, it says, yeah, God is a God of grace. He's a God of forgiveness and healing and all that kind of stuff. And that will happen to you. But you need to read the fine print on this. You see, on the sex stuff, well, you can be healed, but there's always going to be that little stain. It doesn't completely come out. And what I want to tell you today is that is probably the most powerful lie that evil tells us, is the stain. It is a myth. It is a myth of the stain. Because this God who created us, this inventor of the penis and the vagina and the heart and love, this God that created us, this God that knows every dirty little thing about us and loves us, that's not the economy he works in. When we bring this stuff to him and we surrender it to him, there is wholeness and there is healing. And there is no stain whatsoever. We are healed. We are whole. Which is why I can stand here with my sordid sexual resume that I hand. And I can say that there's no stain. There's nothing. You will never see it. Because I am healed. And I am whole. And I am complete. And that's the way that this God who created us loves us. And that's the God that's given us sex. God, we pray and we, like so many times, we don't know exactly what to ask for. So we just ask for love. We know you've got a lot of it and we know we need a lot of it. In Jesus' name, amen.